Happy Fat Tuesday! You've got Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The sounds of New Orleans will be sprinkled throughout our program today. And as always, if there's a track you just need to learn more about, we tweet our music every day at KAR Current State. I want to thank our great lineup of substitute hosts who filled in for me last week and yesterday. MSU Scott Westerman and Sue Carter sounded fabulous. Off the Record's Tim Skubick, many thanks. Joe Lindstroth at the top of his game yesterday as usual. Ditto Emmanuel Berry and Melissa Benmark. I imagine it's the same where you work, but when one person from our team is gone for whatever reason, there's an awful lot of shuffling and reshuffling and re-reshuffling that needs to take place. It's not unlike every workplace, I imagine. But it's no small thing, and it is much appreciated. Later this hour, MSU Poli-Sci Professor Michael Colarisi joins us with a topic as relevant as ever: what happens when outside countries become involved in civil wars? Is that more often good for democracy or bad for democracy? And we learn about the Great Lakes Book Project also this hour. But first, speaking of the Great Lakes, with snow piled deep across the Great Lakes region, there are hopes that the upcoming melt will push lake levels higher. It's a scenario envied by many in the American West, especially in California, where residents are being hammered by the severest drought in three decades. While U.S. states and Canadian provinces bordering the lakes are currently banned from shipping water from the region, the situation begs a bigger question. How could Michigan's and the region's approach to water change over time? And are Great Lakes states and provinces leveraging their water-rich circumstances as well as they can? Well, that's a topic our next guest wrote about recently in the Detroit News. Dale Buss has written about economics and business for Forbes and the Wall Street Journal and other publications. He's based in suburban Detroit. Dale Buss, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
Your article suggests there is a discussion, maybe in its early stages right now, but there is some kind of discussion about how Great Lakes states like Michigan could navigate, pun intended.
This
unique situation we're in with so much fresh water nearby. Tell us more, please.
Well, I think it boils down to the notion of whether Michigan can make better use of the law known as comparative economic advantage. I mean, look at North Dakota. Not known for much, my apologies to them, until oil was discovered there a while ago. It was discovered a long ways back, but when fracking and other methods made it more extractable, suddenly North Dakota has this huge comparative economic advantage, which you see in, you know, booming employment. The economy is taking off there. And so all I was doing in this piece was kind of exploring whether Michigan is doing its best job of exploiting the advantage of being right in the middle of all its fresh water, 21% of the world's supply. Pretty much the answer I came up with is we're not doing nearly as much as we could. And it's not the idea of shipping water wholesale away from the Great Lakes that is for now banned by, as you mentioned, the Great Lakes Compact, although maybe we can get into the notion of how that could change over time. But especially given the drought in California, the idea is, well, they don't have water. They really need it. It's hampering their economy. We have all this water. Are we doing the best job of exploiting in a productive, environmentally sound sense what we have here?
You write that Wisconsin is, quote, surging ahead of regional water rivals in this arena. What kinds of things are they doing in Wisconsin?
Well, the most interesting thing is they have something called the Water Council, and it's an initiative in the Milwaukee area. And in a lot of ways, what Milwaukee is doing is exploiting its own local comparative economic advantage. Much like Detroit is the Motor City, Milwaukee actually has long been a capital of water-intensive industries, going back to the brewing industry, the tanning industry, which was very water-intensive, and that gave rise over the decades to a lot of companies that are in water technology-intensive industries, like one called Badger Meter that makes a lot of the water meters that are used in homes and offices across the country. So what they're doing is a consortium of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, some of these local companies, entrepreneurs, and the state government got involved and said, what can we do to take advantage of this historic strength we have in water technology? And sure enough, they put together something called the Water Council and a Water Initiative, where they have opened up an incubator there. They're trying to get water-intensive startups or technology-intensive startups that have to do with water to be lured to Milwaukee, giving them, you know, tax breaks and incentives, funding, that kind of thing. And it does seem to be putting Milwaukee on the map in the sense that they have drawn a number of startup companies. People are talking about the connection between Milwaukee and this initiative and water. And, you know, what I was suggesting, and Mike Finney, when I talked to him from the MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, you know, did concede that this state hasn't at this point maybe taken advantage of our water resources in this, in a similar sense to, for instance, how Milwaukee has.
Okay. Now, are we talking, we're talking primarily commercial opportunities
here. Well,
but
also research, because there's a heavy tie-in with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee as well. And it is in its formative stages, let's say, but they're probably 2 or 3 years into this effort, and they certainly got a head start on everyone else on the Great Lakes.
Would a shift like this, though, Mike or Dale, rely more on the private sector? I mean, to what extent is government important in leveraging this fresh water?
Well, I think it's like anything. The good ideas can come from government. They can come from the private sector. When it comes to encouraging particular verticals, types of businesses, you know, government can play a hugely important role with tax incentives and other things. And so I think there's a role for both. In Wisconsin, it was definitely and is definitely a private-public partnership, but the initiative can come from anywhere. So it could come from within government. It could come outside. You know, hopefully what would happen in Michigan is more of a happy meeting of private interests and government help, let's say, and incentives in pushing the state, you know, maybe in the direction of taking more advantage of the water that we have.
We're talking with journalist Dale Buss about Michigan's approach to all of its water resources and how that may change over time. It sounds like Michael Finney is at least aware of the possibilities. He's would you agree with that? I mean,
he's
aware there's a lot of upside here.
Yeah, and I think a model for this, in some senses, has been the great success of the Pure Michigan campaign, which, you know, he has been involved with. You know, that started out, of course, as a tourism-based campaign promoting Michigan and our wonderful water resources and a lot of other things. And it's been very, very successful, not only within Michigan, but within the, you know, neighboring states in the Midwest and even as far as the East Coast and Texas and everywhere, getting people to recognize the attractiveness of Michigan as a tourist destination. Now, Mike Finney has been instrumental in kind of pivoting from that to use the Pure Michigan slogan and idea for business development. And I know there's been, you know, talk about, well, for instance, how do we work in the right-to-work idea into this, do we, that kind of thing. So the model is there in a sense for packaging Michigan. It's just it needs to be packaged more directly around the idea of our water resources.
You write also that there are industries, as always, that are more reliant on water than others. With the situation out west, did it ever come up in the people that you spoke with that we may see a migration of some of these water-reliant industries to Michigan over time?
Yes, absolutely. And that is, in fact, part of what Wisconsin is counting on, is you lure businesses that need water. And there's no reason that Michigan couldn't be right in there doing exactly the same thing. And, you know, the advantage could ease over time if water desalination technology ever becomes, let's say, inexpensive and effective enough so that, say, California could just tap right into the Pacific Ocean. But for now, the Great Lakes just remain this incredibly tempting and alluring advantage that we have that they don't. And you never know how politics could change things as well in the coming decades. If climate change really is a long-term phenomenon, you know, we could be revisiting this in 5 or 10 years, and suddenly the Great Lakes Compact doesn't look nearly as safe as it does now.
Did that come up in your
conversation? Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, when you think about the far future, I interviewed Cheryl Connolly, the futurist for Ford, who, you know, made a note to me. She said, look, if you don't have water, you don't have anything. So the notion of blue, of blueness and blue resources indicating water, she said, could very easily and quickly become much more important than any other aspect of greenness, you know, of environmental sensitivities in other ways. And, you know, that's why some of these long-term and natural trends going on bear a lot of watching, obviously.
In doing your story, did you get any inkling that the ongoing drought in other parts of the country might eventually actually undo the water ban prescribed by the Great Lakes Compact?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, when it came together 5 years ago, that was the Great Lakes states and the Canadian provinces were not certain necessarily that they were going to be able to get this passed, you know, the entire U.S. Congress and the Canadian Parliament as well. It, you know, there's a sense that exactly what you're saying, well, geez, all these other states are saying, we really like to find a way to tap in or trade for that water or whatever. Maybe we can send, you know, mangoes or avocados from California for a bunch of water, who knows. But so there is a wariness about that, and it's certainly, you know, politics can uncover lots of possibilities that you never saw before, and so there's no reason to think it won't in this case as well.
Your story reminded me of something that I had forgotten about, and that was basically back in the late 90s, Ontario was looking very closely at exporting Great Lakes water to Asia.
Right, and that was one of the alarming things that sort of prompted the discussions that led to the compact.
Right. Well, we want to thank you for your time. It's an interesting discussion to consider how approaches to water, water policy may change as circumstances change, especially with Michigan in the middle of the Great Lakes. We want to thank our guest, journalist Dale Buss, whose article about this appeared recently in the Detroit News. Thanks, Dale.
Thank you.
Professor Longhair there, and Earl King. It's called Big Chief. As the sounds of New Orleans permeate Current State here on Fat Tuesday, I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. There's probably never been a time in history when there wasn't war and conflict going on somewhere in the world, but between the Arab Spring and the situation between Russia and Ukraine right now, there it seems like an especially good time to talk to an expert on international conflict. Michael Colarisi is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science here at MSU, and he's responsible for a recent study that looks at what happens when outside countries get involved in civil wars. Michael Colarisi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The title of your study is, "With Friends Like These, Who Needs Democracy? The Effect of Transnational Support from Rivals on Post-Conflict Democratization." Summarize for us in layman's terms what you looked at in this study.
Sure, of course. I've been interested for a while in actually how international civil wars actually are. They're very rarely just encapsulated in one state. And so I was interested in particularly how states, when they get involved in these civil wars, giving help to a rival side, right, or the government and the state, what effect that has, not just in the war and the killing and the destruction of the Civil War that's so tragic, but even longer term, after the Civil War ends, when we think about having a post-war democratic trajectory. And so what I found was it's not just, you know, lots of, these are very international things, and there's oftentimes states getting involved, but it's actually particularly states that we have to pay attention to, that when rival or enemy states use the Civil War as a means to their own ends, getting in the way of progress, creating distrust on the side. So, for example, I looked at the FSLN Which was a group in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, which received help from Costa Rica, which was unpopular. They had a territorial dispute. And after they won, this was a very sort of unpopular alliance that was formed during the Civil War. And it changed the calculus after the Civil War of the government that they didn't really want to democratize because they were going to lose the next election. Mm. Right. So why would you then have, you know, these winners that got there from unpopular means creating democratic institutions that are going to lead them to lose power? Mm. So that's what I was interested in. That's what the study explores, is those form, those types of relationships.
How many different civil wars did you look at?
Sure. I looked at 136 civil wars, particularly the 10 years after each of those civil wars from 1946 up till 2007. Is when I stopped looking at the post-conflict settings.
Does that account for all of the civil wars in that period,
yeah,
or most of them, or what?
I'm an academic, so we like to disagree over definitions of things. So there's, you know, give or take a couple. Yes, that's all of them.
Okay.
That's quite enough killing and destruction.
I mean, context, I would think, is just enormously important in this discussion. You saw that in some countries, one side had gotten help from an outside nation, money and weapons in particular. Who were they getting help from? What relationship did the outside countries have to the factions in the Civil War?
Sure. That varied a lot, actually. Sometimes it's, for example, in what we see in the Ukrainian case, you know, right now, where the outside state or government who's going to be intervening, giving money, help, sometimes military aid, right, is actually saying that they're protecting a minority, right, either linguistic or religious. So sometimes there is a kinship or connection. Sometimes it's ideology. So, for example, there are outside groups like Vietnam that became involved with the Khmer Rouge, right, helping them get power in Cambodia. But many times there's actually no kinship at all, and it's just a relationship based on sort of, you know, raw power politics. So, for example, Libya didn't like at all some of the goals of the National Front in Chad, Frelinghat, but they gave them lots of support because once they got in power, right, they actually gave them territory back. There was a territorial dispute between Libya and Chad. So sometimes these civil wars, these rebel groups, are useful levers, right, for rivals and enemies outside of the
sure.
state. And so that has, you know, a big impact on the Civil War, but unfortunately it also has an impact after the Civil War when people are thinking, should I trust this government, right, would I vote for them, and knowing that, you know, whether they build democratic institutions or not.
How often does an outside player get the result they want?
Yeah, so it's a little less than a quarter of civil wars when they happen, although it really varies by what else is going on in the Civil War. So this is one of the interesting things of the study, is these are dangerous relationships where you have this rival-rebel alliance that's going on. And so, for example, in Ukraine, we might be very worried, for example, if Russia takes over Ukraine, installs a leader that's pro-Russian but would be very unpopular in Ukraine, why would they democratize then, right, if they're going to lose the elections, right? They're going to be forced to run, you know, from repression and undemocratic means. And so that's, you know, a very important thing to think about.
Could one draw the parallel that when bigger nations supply factions in smaller nations with money or weapons, it almost ends up being like the classic enabler from your 12-step programs? Is that in any way an accurate analogy to draw?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some of that, although for sure there's an addiction to some extent, right, to that external support. That in democracy, your power comes from the people, right? Autocracy, your power has to come from somewhere else, not the people, either elites in the country, but it can also come from elites outside of the country. And so I think that's useful, although I would push back a little bit against this idea that you become addicted to it. I don't think it's necessarily addiction. I just think it's a rather tragic, cold logic that there's a market for support during a civil war. You're trying to win, and there's a market from outside. There's a supply of this type of aid, and it has rather tragic consequences after the Civil War because, you know, trust is a hard thing to earn back.
And oftentimes I imagine if the outside force aligns with the successful party, there's an anticipation of some kind of ongoing relationship, some kind of payback over the longer haul.
Yes, absolutely.
Which can get very complicated, I'm sure.
Yes.
One of the things you're trying to do with this study is to forecast where democratization will happen after a civil war. Are there other factors that determine if a country will become more democratic after a civil war?
So this is one, I think, important relationship, the sort of rival-rebel alliance. idea. The other thing that the study illuminated that's important is engagement with the outside world, trade openness, right? Being part of intergovernmental organizations that also have democracies. Democratic institutions need to be learned. They need to be built. They're not sort of prefabricated where you just sort of plop them down and you've got a capital and a constitution.
Certainly.
They take time. So actually having advisors, learning, having that support out there from the democratic community and engaging with that seems to make a difference, and it does seem to help.
So if democratic nations like ours want to help grow new democracies, what in your view is the best thing that established democracies can do?
So one of the, I think the important things is they need to coordinate. One of the really big problems with these rebel alliances is they win more often when the United Nations or other democratic nations aren't there to get them out. So while rival rebel alliances are equally split between when the UN has boots on the ground in a civil war, for example, and when they don't, they never win when the UN becomes involved. So when the international community creates, some stable structure, right, a counterbalance, to these cold power politic logics, rarely do we have the same problem of having very unpopular leaders emerge from the civil war. So I think that's something that they can do. I think the Ukraine is an example where it doesn't necessarily have to be boots on the ground, but the EU, the US, and the UN has to be very cognizant of that a Russian-controlled, unpopular government in the Ukraine will not be democratic.
How do you keep your head around all of the dynamics in play in just the Middle East?
Oh, sure.
I mean, the Arab Spring happened after your study was
yes.
finished, but that has to be, that's an incredible laboratory, I suppose, in a way, for democracy and such.
Yes. I mean, it's both an exciting and troubling time, I think, in the Middle East and around where, one of the reasons people are interested in democratization after civil wars is they think, wow, isn't this a great time to build democracy, where you have these previous institutions, a lot of times autocratic institutions have fallen, right? So you have sort of fertile ground for building something new. But what you build new doesn't necessarily have to be democracy. And this is what we're finding, that, people have sort of changed from calling it the Arab Spring, to the Arab uprisings. And, a little less optimistic. And I think the optimism varies a lot, where you have Tunisia, which maybe you can be more optimistic about. It's a homegrown group that
Egypt.
Doesn't have many ties.
Egypt is a lot less predictable, correct?
Absolutely. And perhaps you might have had more democracy if you still had the Muslim Brotherhood, because they were more popular.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, very severely Assyria, with entangling, rivalries and alliances from Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, already becoming involved in that civil war. And right now, regardless of which side wins, they've sort of had to make very unpopular alliances just to get this far.
Well, it's so fascinating to consider what happens when the democratic process results in a more autocratic approach. Isn't that one of the huge conundrums that we're seeing play out here? Mohamed Morsi was democratically elected. Yanukovych was democratically elected, but they still generate an awful lot of opposition.
Yeah, no, I think it's very clear democracy is very hard. And if democracy doesn't work, right, if it doesn't deliver on some of its promises, people are going to seek economic growth, stability, security, all the things we need, right, in an institutional form. That they hope will give it to them.
Michael, what are you watching most closely in the Ukraine situation?
Sure, two things. I'm tracking Ukrainian nationalism. Right, I think this is one of these cases where Russia and Putin has to sort of be careful what they wish for. That I think they possibly could hold on to the Crimea with military force. But it has a very large non-Russian minority there that would not be happy with that. It would be an occupation. It would be costly, for sure. And that only grows if they continue and sort of marched on eastern Ukraine. That proportion grows even bigger. At the same time, you have this dynamic where Ukraine, which has always been explained as sort of having weak nationalism, right? Lots of different groups, Tartars, Russians, right? Ukrainians there. Well, they're becoming more nationalistic every day. You have people signing up for the military and other things. So you have a relatively weak government that just started, that called elections for May 25th, and Russia's actions are actually rallying people behind this government. And so it strikes me that there's quite a few counterproductive events happening for Russia itself.
Mm-hmm. We want to thank our guest, Professor Michael Colarisi, an associate professor in the Department of Political Science here at MSU. He is looking at, just concluded a study that looks at what happens when outside countries get involved in civil wars. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Most people who live in the Mitten State have fond memories of time spent at one of the Great Lakes, if not more. Those memories are what fuel the Great Lakes Book Project. The book captures over 20 personal stories about life along the shoreline, and Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Walter Blake Knobloch, the book's publisher. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Real good.
So many Michiganders, as you know, and people across the Midwest have personal tales about the Great Lakes. For instance, I remember my uncle losing his wedding ring in Lake Michigan and searching for it for hours and hours on end, or going up to Grand Haven and grabbing a pronto pup before heading to the beach.
Yeah.
So, you know, this book captures all of those powerful memories, those powerful bonds that people across the region and across the world, for that matter, have with the Great Lakes. The book's publisher and editor, Walter Blake Knobloch, came up with the idea for the project during the summer of 2012.
I was a senior in college. It was summer 2012, and I was living in Ann Arbor off of Vaughn Street, which is in kind of the student housing area, and it was a duplex, and I was on the second floor of the top of the duplex, and I don't know if you remember that time, but the book 50 Shades of Grey was kind of popular, and so I wasn't taking classes, and I was just kind of to myself, and I was sitting in the top floor of the duplex, and I read 50 Shades of Grey, and it was just the worst book I've ever read. it was pretty terrible, and I don't know if someone likes that. I'm not saying it's like inherently bad. I mean, I guess I kind of am, but I'm not saying you have to think that. But what I thought is, this is just a god awful book. It doesn't really make sense. It's not good, and yet it sold hundreds of thousands, I don't know, a million copies around the world. And so I was sitting in my room on my bed, just kind of sweating, reading this terrible, terrible book. And I said, you know, if they can do this, I can do this. If I can make a book that has some sort of substance to it, I mean, right? And
yeah.
And sell, and maybe not sell a million copies, but you know, maybe get in front of a few people.
Why did you decide to have these books center around the Great Lakes?
Because I grew up in Michigan. I was born in Flint, and I grew up in Traverse City, and so the Great Lakes have been kind of this, especially like Michigan, this, you know, ubiquitous presence in my life, and I've traveled around, and I've been to, you know, the desert, and I've traveled to other places too. I backpacked from Amsterdam down to Sicily. I've seen a lot of cool stuff, but there's literally nothing at all like the Great Lakes. I can say that, and I mean it. There's no freshwater body that's so big. It's ridiculous. And so if I said, okay, this is something that I know everyone, not everyone, most people feel the same way about this, because it's such a unique thing. Not everyone can relate to like stories from my life, but everyone can relate to the Great Lakes in some way in their own life.
Tell me about some of those memories that make you have such a strong association with the Great Lakes.
Well, when I was in high school, in my first year, second year of college, my friends and I, there was maybe 12 of us, we saw an old pontoon boat on the side of the road up in Traverse City. It was kind of out in the boonies, and it was like $200. And it wasn't safe, of course, because, you know, it was $200. But we
yeah.
we bought it, and we fixed it up, and I'm using air quotes over over here in Detroit. We didn't fix it up. We just, you know, spray painted it black and put some drywall on there. Not drywall, some wood on there. It was actually like three stories tall. There was the main floor, a second floor on top, and then we had like a rooftop deck that was just, you know, 10 or 15 feet high in the air, and you were supposed to hit a golf ball off there. But it was just very, very dangerous, and it was chaotic. But anyways, back to your question, that's one of my best memories, coincidentally, even though it was just this floating disaster, and oftentimes it wasn't even that. It was more or less a sinking disaster. I really enjoyed everything about that, and we would drive around West Bay up in Traverse City and just you know, enjoy the sunshine and the three or four months of summer were allotted in northern Michigan. And just that's the kind of thing that I don't think anyone else outside of the Great Lakes region, and maybe not outside of even, you know, living on the lakeshore, I guess, would have the chance to make a makeshift pirate ship. But it's just something that I really look back fondly upon, and it was kind of stupid and dangerous, but that's the best stories always have some element of stupidity in them, I guess, yeah. Right?
There's such a wide variety of topics in this book and writing styles. Could you give us just a couple examples to kind of illustrate that variety?
D.E. Green, who's a Minnesota guy, he has some really, really great poems in there. But then, I hate to say one of them is my favorite, like I was telling you earlier. I hate to pick out a favorite, but just to explain, like, for example, there's like a first-person narrative. Michael Mayday, who's a guy that I know, he talks about his story is Hunting the Whitetail. And that's a first-person narrative. D.E. Green has a collection of poems, and they're really, they've got great imagery. You read them, and you feel like, okay, I know what it's like to see the things he saw. And then Matthew Gavin Frank, who's a great author and he lives in Marquette. Elements of the past, you know, its relation to the lake, is kind of like a conceptual, almost surreal work of nonfiction that talks about past season Lake Superior, and it kind of jumps around, and it isn't have your normal plot structure of a story. But at the same time, you finish with it and say, okay, I don't really know what that was about necessarily, but I know what he was trying to say. I don't want to give it away, but he's got a very distinct reverence for Lake Superior.
Is this book just a book for Great Lakes people, quotation marks over here on my end? Do you hope that this reaches others outside the region?
If you haven't been to the Great Lakes region, you can read this book and say, okay, you know, this is a good book. It's not, you know, I've never been to, I've never walked up and down the Appalachian Trail, but I read Walk in the Woods. And I appreciated the book, you know, for its lessons and whatever. If you've never been to the upper Midwest, you can read this book and say, okay, you know, I get that. But where I think it really has so much more power is people not necessarily have lived here, but have even visited here. We've sold books in South Africa. I've shipped books to Australia, England, South Korea. Because the Great Lakes are so powerful, people see them. And even if they don't live here, they've only spent a day or a week or, you know, half a day on the shores of Lake Michigan or Ontario or Huron or wherever it is, it sticks with them. And so this isn't necessarily a book just for Great Lakes people because it's, you know, it's good writing, but it definitely is a book for people who have taken a piece of the Great Lakes with them.
You had over 300 submissions for the book. Have you ever considered doing a second collection or multiple collections, making it a series of sorts?
Yeah, that's what I'm working with right now. I really wanted to do a volume 2, and I like the idea of this communal storytelling where it's stories sourced from the entire region. And right now I'm thinking, okay, do I want to take this idea and take it to other regions of the United States? Do I have the ability to do that? Do I have the, you know, the time and manpower? Because that's something that I think that it's been, the book has been so well received that I like the idea of helping create the same type of community somewhere else. But at the same time, like I said, the book's been so well received. I'd also like to create a second volume, like I was saying. And so maybe instead of, you know, emailing 10,000 people and getting 300 responses, I can talk to newspapers and blogs or radio shows like this and not actually have to have to do that, and actually create a better, a different type of book. Because, I mean, what I did is most of these authors probably, I'd say it's an 80-20 mix of authors like who are actual authors and professors, and then the 20 is like regular people, for lack of a better term, you know, people who just like to write and live in the upper Midwest. And I think if I could have more exposure and people know that, okay, this guy is like a, you know, he's legit, the book project is a real thing, I could get a wider selection of ordinary people who have
great,
you know,
stories,
more or less ordinary lives, but maybe one really, really, really awesome story, or maybe a few awesome stories, but one that they want to write about. And so, if anybody out there is interested, go to our website, which is thegreatlakesbookproject.com, and sign up for our newsletter. And then we're going to be doing updates about when we're going to be looking for more submissions and how the path of the Great Lakes Book Project is going.
Great. So when people read this book, what is it that you hope they take away with after reading it?
Well, you know, I hope on a superficial level, I hope they enjoy reading it. I hope they, you know, if they sit down at, and they've got 15 minutes to kill and they read a story about passes, I hope that they enjoyed it. But bigger than that, I want people to understand that there's, I mean, sometimes people in our lives, we can kind of feel lonely and like we're isolated because the feelings we have are so far off from how we assume everyone else feels. And I want people to read this and say, you know, wow, I read one of these 25 stories and I felt just like that. And I think that idea of connecting is really, really important. And so what I want people to take away besides enjoying the book is to read it and know that for whatever reason it is, that there's someone out there who feels a lot like them. That's really important to me.
Walter Blake Knobloch is the editor and publisher of the Great Lakes Book Project. This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. More of the sounds of New Orleans here today on Fat Tuesday on Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. According to the most recent numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 800,000 women work in the construction industry across the country. That's about 9% of the total workforce. The National Association of Women in Construction, or NAWIC, has built a support network of more than 140 chapters around the world to assist many of these women in the largely male-dominated construction field. The organization was founded in 1953 by 16 women working in the industry in Fort Worth, Texas. NAWIC's Lansing chapter became Michigan's first in 1971. I spoke with two members of Lansing-Nawick about local women in construction. Mary Ellen Brocklehurst is the Student Services Coordinator for the Eaton Risa Career Preparation Center, and she runs Nawick's Summer Camp for Young Girls. Jane Smith is the Lansing Chapter's Vice President and a controller for a local heating and air conditioning company. Jane began the conversation by talking about her group's membership.
Our organization is for women in all facets of the construction industry. It's not like some of the trade associations where everyone's an electrician or something. This is women that are involved with any aspect of construction. In fact, we have different levels of membership. We have associate members that can even be, we have an attorney here in the local area that as long as they work in some way with construction, they can be a member.
Mm-hmm.
And our core purpose is to enhance the success of women in construction. And so we welcome people from all aspects of the industry. And for myself, in my job, I'm a controller with a heating company. And there aren't a lot of other women at my level of management. So it's nice for me to have some networking opportunities with other women in the area that are in similar positions. We offer a lot of different educational programs that our members can take advantage of through the Nawick Education Foundation. So there's just a wealth of information.
What has it been like for you as a woman to be working in a pretty male-dominated right. environment?
Yeah. In our company, in heating and air, it's a very physical job, so most of our employees are men. Fortunately, they're very respectful, and you know, you do hear some tales of women that are out in the field
right.
having difficulty,
sure.
but in the office, I work primarily in the office as an accountant and human resources and various, wear a lot of hats in a small business, which is challenging and fun at the same time.
But you said that there were not that many women
right.
who had risen to that level in your kind of business.
That's correct. Most of the women at my company and quite a lot of other companies in construction are more in a clerical position, and even myself to a degree. But I will admit our general manager does clerical as well. As a lot of that is the size of the company too. You know, we are. Managers aren't above to be able to rule out tasks like that. But overall, a lot of the members in Nawick are actually out in the field. We have one of our members is a soil and materials engineer, and she goes right out on job sites and taking soil samples and working with crews. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, they don't let me out of the office very much. But some of our members are more actively out in the workforce, you know.
Mary Ellen, you offer some mentoring programs for girls and young women. One of the biggest is called Mentor a Girl in Construction Camp, or Magic Camp. You're the camp coordinator. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the camp itself is a partnership between some significantly big organizations. Magic Camp itself, basically the big partners, we put together the camp. It's a one-week experience for young girls, 14 to 17-year-olds. Every day of the camp, they experience a different trade or a different construction-related career. One day they do electrical, they do a day of welding, they do a day of actual building construction. They get to operate heavy equipment machines, and then they go to the Michigan Bricklayers Association for an experience there.
Who leads these sessions?
We have, what we've done is we work with women who are in each of these trades. So we have women electricians who come in. We have a women welding staff that comes in. We try to focus every single area for women leading the actual training to the girls. So each day they do have the women that are doing the facilitating for the camp, which is really great because we really, at our school, the Eaton Educational Regional Service Agency, or Eaton RESA, we are trying to increase the girls in the non-traditional careers, and it really has made a difference by having the camp. And the girls, when they come in, they're sometimes nervous or awkward, a little unsure of themselves, but through every day they build confidence. We really try to encourage them to feel good about what they're doing, to have passion for the different areas, because I think sometimes women don't feel, they may have the desire or the energy, the interest, but they don't feel supported. And so the camp really does provide that experience for them.
So how do girls enroll in Magic Camp?
In order for a girl to enroll in Magic Camp, there's a couple of ways they can do it. And I just wanted to mention the dates. It's in June. The date of the camp is June 16th to June 20th, and it's held at Lansing Community College West Campus. And to enroll in the camp, the best way to do it is to just send an email to Brocklm, B-R-O-C-K-L-M, at lcc.edu, and I'll get an application out. It's a paper application. Basically, the parents have to sign the application process, answer a couple of questions, fill out the information, and send it on. You can also go to our website at eatonresa.org to actually look at the application, the brochure as well.
Is there tuition involved or a fee?
There is no tuition. This is a free experience for girls, and it's about a $600 value. The students receive all the materials, T-shirt, hard hat, tools, all the materials for all the different projects. Every day there's a specific project the students will be doing, field trips. Everything is included, meals. We even provide transportation to the students through bus tokens. So it's a wonderful collaboration between NAWIC, LCC, and then Eaton Resa Career Center. And no, there really isn't any cost involved, and we do accept students from the Tri-County area. So not only Eaton County students, but students from Ingham County and Clinton County as well.
Jane, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the environment, though, again, mm-hmm. in such what has been a more of a male-dominated landscape. Were there times when you thought this wasn't the right career path for you?
For myself, not so much. But I know I do have a personal experience that's similar to what Mary Ellen is talking about with I was probably in one of the earlier ages where they asked you to take shop classes, and we would have a 6-week class. I loved the drill press, and I loved making things with wood. And my grandfather was a carpenter, and I loved that. But I was never encouraged to go into carpentry or do anything with a trade like that. And even in the class when I loved using the equipment and stuff, the boys would kind of make fun of the girls. Or, you know, you didn't feel, like Mary Ellen said, that you had encouragement to actually consider that as a career.
Right.
And I think that's, we have had women work. I had a woman that was a duct hanger out on when the new house business was in full swing. And she actually worked out in the new houses and hung ductwork, and she fit right in. Our crews worked alongside. You know, I was a little worried as a human personnel person that when we sent her out, like if I told her, let me know if these guys aren't treating you right, and she just fit right in. So I was happy to see that, and I was happy that I didn't hear any horror stories of her being abused out on a job site or, you know, maybe not treated fairly. But as far as I know, I mean, it was a very compatible crew. One of our foremen at the time had worked down in Florida, and there were a lot more women on the crews down there than there are here in Michigan. So he was experienced in it, and it just went very smoothly. So I don't have any really, like, crazy story to tell you, but I do know that it worked, and it's just such a physical, demanding job. We really don't get a lot of applicants. We don't in this day and age right now, the building boom kind of went away. And so a lot of people that had those skills, I believe, you know, followed work down south in different areas. So right now we are actually having a hard time hiring. And so that makes our role with the Women in Construction and other trade associations to try to train people and get people interested in careers in our industry very critical right now. Because if people don't go into construction, these roads that we're looking at that are starting to fall apart, they're not going to get fixed by themselves. We need people to go into the trades and learn how to run the equipment and learn how to do it. It's a very satisfying career to start with a hole in the ground, and then all of a sudden there's a building. There's some definite job satisfaction to that. So, you know, we just really want to get the word out. This is Women in Construction Week. We're celebrating this week. We want people to know about careers in construction and that there's a lot of good companies out there.
We're talking with Jane Smith and Mary Ellen Brocklehurst about women in construction. How do girls view these industries nowadays?
I think in this day and age, there's a lot better support for girls to be actually consider these areas. I still think there's some stigma out there with you know, individuals that want to do this. It's like that's a guy thing, but I believe those barriers are breaking down. And organizations like NAWIC, as well as you know, good teachers who provide those support, as well as women role models, provide that necessary support and encouragement for girls. So, like Jane was saying, and you know, shop class, we hear that often, and we talk about that in one of the first days of camp.
Is that still out there?
Oh, I think to some extent. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of schools and budget cuts and so forth, there's not as many opportunities like the hands-on classes, and a lot of times students don't get those until they're a little bit older in high school or like the program like we have at our career center. But I think that even now, there are still some challenges when girls come into the non-traditional careers, but I think it's much, much better than what it used to be. I think in the past, when girls were in these classes, they may be viewed on with certain stereotypes and different, you know, they didn't feel like they belonged, wasn't cool, you know, to be in those classes. But now I think it's more accepting, and I think that in this day and age that girls are encouraged more to consider those options.
Are we going to see more women-owned construction companies, construction operations?
I think so. And we at Magic Camp, we like I mentioned before, we always have women facilitators. One of the first things we do in that first day is we kick off with a woman-owned construction company. We've done a couple different members over the years from NAWIC, and it's just really great to hear them talk and to share about their path and how difficult it was for them. Some of these companies have been around for, you know, maybe 30 plus years, and they talk about how in the beginning, how hard it was. But now it's easier to get loans. It's easier. Women are more accepting. And I also know that in industry, there's certain standards that some of the larger companies, federal companies, they have to have certain percentage of women actually on their team in the different trades. So I think all in all, it's getting better over time.
Very interesting. Jane Smith is the vice president of the Lansing chapter of the National Association of Women in Construction, and Mary Ellen Brocklehurst is the student services coordinator for Eaton Risa Career Preparation Center. Thanks to both of you for joining us today to discuss women in construction.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll look at the parallels between road funding in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. Also, we'll learn more about Cello Fury, a rock band featuring three cellists. Tell Tchaikovsky the news. That and more Wednesday on Current State. Have a happy Fat Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.